there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 304. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to Ken at thisshowisogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is thisshowisogay. And of course, stroll on over to the Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have an amazing show for you this week. We must get started with this week's guest. Dean Hamer is a filmmaker, a change agent, a storyteller. He is a scientist turned author and filmmaker. His book, The Science of Desire, The Search for the Gay Gene, was a New York Times Book of the Year, and he's been featured in Time Magazine, ABC, CBS, NBC News, Discovery, BBC Science Shows, Frontline, and Oprah. Together with his incredible partner, Joe Wilson, they were the co-directors of Out in the Silence, an Emmy Award-winning documentary that has evolved into the Out in the Silence campaign for justice and equality in rural and small town America and the National Out in the Silence Youth Activism Award. Their current work, based in Hawaii, focuses on the intersections between culture, gender, and identity as revealed through the just riveting story, Kumuhina. I watched this documentary the other day and I was glued to the screen, and you will be too on Monday, May 4th, when it premieres on PBS. Dean Hamer, welcome back to This Show Is So Gay.
It's so nice to be back.
I say welcome back. It's really like the first time. You were first on this show with Joe 6 years ago, back on episode, I just looked it up, episode number 25.
Oh my gosh, we were virgins in the process. Both as filmmakers and also as guests on your radio show.
Oh, well, it's such a treat to have you here. We have so much to talk about, sir. Are you ready?
I'm absolutely ready to go.
All right, let's do it. Well, let's take a step back. And Joe was going to be on the show, but he's taken ill and we want him to be well. So we're wishing him well, and you will tell him that for us?
Thank you. I certainly will.
Okay.
He wishes he could be here.
Well, what we did learn about you on that episode number 25 way back when is that you told us one of the secrets to success for the two of you is to have separate studies. Is that still the case?
Yes, it is. The difference is that at that time, I had a study overlooking an alleyway in D.C. that was full of rats, and Joe had a little sort of nook in the house. And 4 years ago, we moved to Hawaii, and now I'm sitting in my study overlooking the Pacific Ocean, and Joe is actually lying down in our bedroom, but if his eyes were open, he would also be seeing the Pacific Ocean.
Wow.
It's been quite a change in venue, but we still work very much together, but with slightly separate spaces.
Gotcha. These aren't metaphors. You really are overlooking the ocean.
Yes, if we were on FaceTime, which is not really possible on the radio, I realize, you would see the blue Pacific Ocean in front of you, and several thousand miles between us and anybody else, between the mainland USA in one direction or Asia in the other direction.
Wow. And you do understand that my view here in Cleveland is slightly different.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Just checking. All right. Well, let's start. We have so much to discuss. Let's take a step back, starting out. Why the medium of film for you to get your voice out there, Dean? Obviously, you have a pretty non-traditional background for a filmmaker. What is it about the medium of film that really gets you excited?
I think film is wonderful because it lets a person into another character's life, and it lets a person into another character's world in a very obvious way, because you're actually seeing the images on the screen in front of you. You're actually hearing the person's voice. Of course, you can write about that, and writers can be very, very effective, or you can talk about it on the radio, but film presents the entire picture. And when filmmaking became available for ordinary people because of the advances in equipment and digitalization, it really became a great way for us to start talking and spreading the word about the things that we are interested in.
Nice. Given your background, how does that change your lens? What uniqueness do you think that you, Dean Hamer, bring to the filmmaking process?
Oh, I don't know if I bring any uniqueness, except the realization that in order to get people to understand things, It has to be at a human level.
Yeah.
And that's true whether it's complicated science or whether it's about human rights and about equality, that you just have to bring things to a human level to have people comprehend.
And he's not on the call. He's laying down, so we can talk about him because he's not here. Talk to our listening audience about what you think Joe Wilson brings to the filmmaking process.
Well, Joe Wilson comes from a very different background. He's been involved in human rights and in activism for his entire life, and had been involved with some groups that fund projects and do very important work in that way. And I think that he also saw that if you really want to bring these issues to people, you've got to humanize it somehow.
Yeah.
And so he really came from the sort of humanist side with the idea of getting those ideas more widely known.
Nice. Nice. What generally, I mean, you mentioned this human aspect, which is so hugely important in having audiences connect with your content. What do you two look for in order to spark your interest before you decide on the focus for a film?
I think the two things are, first of all, one of the issues that we're interested in, you know, for us, LGBT issues and issues of social equity and equality are always preeminent. But perhaps the most important thing is a good character,
yeah.
Somebody who other people can relate to, somebody who really brings the story alive. And it's one of those things, it's like charisma, it's very hard to define, but when you see a good character, when you see an interesting person, everybody recognizes it. And so that's really key.
Yeah. Now, can we do a little bit of chicken and egg? Which came first, your move to Hawaii or your decision to focus on this content that we'll get to of your latest work?
You know, like so many things in life, they sort of happen simultaneously due to a whole number of different causes. I had started coming out to Hawaii first as a tourist about 20 years before. I was very attracted by the philosophy and the people here, also by the Asian influence here because I speak Chinese and Japanese and have had a long-standing interest in that part of the world. And then as Joe and I began working more and more on LGBT issues, the realization that there's such a different attitude, such a fundamentally different philosophy out here in Hawaii really made it attractive. And so when we met Kinale Moanawankalu, the subject of our film, it was kind of a real natural to want to pursue that.
How did you guys meet?
Well, it was very simple. She was a very good friend with a good friend of ours, Connie Flores, who's a co-producer on the film and who we had known for quite a while. She's involved in the Gay Film Festival out here and other activities. And Connie told us about this amazing woman that she had been working with and known for 20 years, and we were interested in meeting. And so we went to go to dinner, and we met in the parking lot of it's like Kenny's restaurant, a little local kind of place. And just walking from the parking lot to Kenny's restaurant took us about a half an hour because so many people came up and started saying, "Oh, Kumu, how are you?" Old people, young people. And it was really quite extraordinary because for a transgender person in the United States to have that sort of level of acceptance and respect and of people knowing her in an ordinary setting like a restaurant parking lot would be unusual to say the least. And so by the time we got to dinner, we thought, oh, this could be pretty interesting.
And so I imagine that you and Joe went home that night and you had a conversation and you just said, we have to do this.
No, it actually happened even earlier than that. We were thinking as we were having dinner that we would want to do a project on Hina, but we were still living in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
And we thought we would come back and maybe start filming her at school. And then very casually, just as we were getting to leave the restaurant, Hina told us, oh, I'm so glad that the summer vacation is coming up because last year on vacation, I married this 25-year-old guy from Tonga, and now he's down in Fiji waiting for me to come pick him up and bring him back home. And I was like, oh, that's kind of unusual.
Actually. Yeah.
He is 40, and I'm, you know, Hawaiian. And I just said right then and there, oh, we got to start filming right away. And Joe and I, we didn't even have to talk it over. Right? It was just like, how are we going to get ourselves to Tonga? So yeah, it's just a natural.
Well, Dean, I am very much not a documentary filmmaker, so you need to break some of this down for me. Do you have a goal in mind, or do you just see where the footage takes you?
You know, different types of documentary filmmakers have very different processes. And there are some people, like a Ken Burns, when he meant to make a movie about the Civil War, you can be sure he had it pretty well planned out. First of all, he knew how it was going to end. And secondly, a whole team of researchers and historians. And so it's very planned out. Our style of filmmaking is exactly the opposite. We pick a person and maybe a subject, and then we just see how the story develops. And so in this case, it's always a little bit scary. We thought we were going to be making a film about Hina meeting her husband and their love story. And it is partially about that, but it turned into something very, very different in the middle of filming.
So what are we going to see? I've already seen it, so you don't have to tell me, but tell our listening audience what generally they are going to see on Monday, May 4th, when this film premieres.
Sure. Well, they're going to see the life of an extraordinary teacher and cultural person named Hina Wong. She's a native Hawaiian and very true to Hawaiian values. She's mahu, which we would call transgender, but in Hawaii is really looked at as a special type of person who is a mixture of male and female and combines the best of male and female spirit. And you'll see her teaching at school. The cool story that developed is that she was trying to teach some high school boys how to do a very masculine chant, something that normally men only do, and they just weren't getting it very much. But then one day, this little 11-year-old girl walks up and says, "Let me try that." Everyone poo-poos her, though this is only for men, but she takes a shot, and it develops into a really remarkable story of a teacher and a student working together to overcome the odds. I won't tell you the exact ending, but it's pretty exciting, and I hope people will take a look at it on Monday.
Nice. Oh, gosh, it's so amazing to watch. It's so amazing to watch. Can we talk a little bit about the intimate moments in the film? What's going through your head as you're filming them? I mean, I know that you both are professionals, but there has to be, I would imagine, this human part of you where you're thinking that in other circumstances, that which you are filming would be a private moment.
Yes, that's always an issue, and some of the intimate moments that we filmed between Hina and her new husband were even disturbing, I would say. But I feel like the people that are in our films have agency, and that if they're allowing themselves to be filmed, then they're either wanting that moment to be known, or at least they're not opposed to it. And we talked with Hina afterward as we were finishing the film up about that. And she said, well, I know some of the moments were something that people wouldn't ordinarily want to have exposed. But I feel like if this is going to be of value at all, then I've got to show people the whole picture. I can't just pretend to be this, you know, rosy school teacher. People need to see all the different aspects of my life. So, yeah, we thought that was important to include.
Again, listeners, we are here with filmmaker Dean Hamer. His new documentary with his partner Joe Wilson, Kumu Hina, premieres on PBS on Monday, May 4th. There's such an amazing generational aspect to this film. Talk to me about what you discovered in working with Hawaiian youth around this topic.
Well, in Hawaii, there's a very strong cultural respect for elders called kupuna, and the belief that they really are the carriers of knowledge. And you can see that playing out in the film because Hina, although she's younger than me, is a kapuna. She's a knowledgeable person. And you can just see the love that engenders amongst all of the students. So they really look up to her. There's a common thing in Hawaii that to learn, you don't ask questions and read things in books. You watch what other people are doing and learn from that. And there's a very strong element of that. And I think what's really wonderful about the way the story plays out is that here in the continental U.S., when people talk about transgender kids or gender nonconforming kids or whatever, people often say, oh, you should be tolerant of them. You should accept them. You should like them, you know, regardless of the way that they are. But you can see in this story that this little girl, Honani, isn't respected despite being a mixture of a boy and a girl. It's part of her personality, and it's part of the respect that she engendered. And what happens at the end is that that's good not just for her. It's good for the entire school. It's good for everybody around her. And so I think that's really one of the important messages of teaching from the film.
Dean, what did you learn about yourself over the course of creating this film?
I think the most important thing that I learned, and I think Joe would say the same, is that we Westerner guys don't necessarily always have all of the answers to things. In fact, there's a lot of things where other people have better solutions and answers. And when it comes to gender, Hawaiians know a lot more than we do.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, there's always this feeling as we look around the world, usually when people talk about international LGBT issues, what they're really saying is, oh, it's so sad that in Africa they're terrible, or this place they're terrible, or that place they're terrible. But there's other places that are better. And those are places that we should be learning from.
And speaking of, you guys wrote a piece for the Huffington Post called What Could Indiana Learn from Hawaii? In that piece, you wrote, folks in Indiana, Arkansas, and every place else where people think that religious and LGBT rights are an either-or proposition should take a close look, you know, at Hawaii. What prompted you to put that piece out there?
Well, I think there was all of this furor over the so-called religious protection law in Indiana, and it's really all in this idea that somehow religion and LGBT are opposite. But there are a lot of places where LGBT is part of the religion or part of the spiritual tradition, and Hawaii is one of those.
Yeah.
The idea of mahu as being people that are elevated because of their dual gender status is something that has really deep roots in the spirituality of the people. And the whole idea of aloha, of love and honor and respect for everybody, is part of the spiritual beliefs of the place. So I think that's important for people to understand.
There was that one moment in the film where I think it's the principal of the school just talks about the word aloha, and that when you say that word, just the degree to which it should come from the heart. It was really just an incredible display of explaining a culture that so many of us just have no familiarity with. In fact, including, it sounds like, you know, a lot of people who tried to quote-unquote colonize Hawaii.
Yes, that's what they call in Hawaii a chicken skin moment. She's really quite extraordinary, and especially when she talks about how they had in school, they had to salute the flag that took over the country. It's really, really moving. And we do hope that one other learning from the film is that people will understand just a little bit more about the situation in Hawaii, that you know, it's a beautiful vacation spot, but it's also an occupied territory, an illegally occupied territory of the United States.
Yeah. The subject of your film, Kumuhina, she has definitely endured quite a number of just backlash. I was reading a piece that you guys put out there about how Republicans were even stepping up and bashing her presence in this school.
Yes, they were, and not a surprise. The good thing about Hawaii is it's not even Republicans anymore. There's only one Republican in the Senate, so it's not a very strong. It's a strong reaction. But it doesn't carry a great deal of traction here because it's overall a pretty progressive place. What has been interesting about Kumuhina is that she's not just involved in gender issues. In fact, that's relatively low down in all the things that she's involved with. She's very deeply involved with the Hawaiian community and with sovereignty. And you may have seen recently that we're having quite a battle here over Mauna Kea, a beautiful big mountain, and over whether they should build another big telescope there. And Hina has been very much involved with that and up on the mountain for several days. So that's really become one of her major causes.
Now, I don't want to say that you have a particular loyalty, but I would imagine you have the scientist side of you. Does that affect your view on Mauna Kea and the building of a telescope?
Well, it does, because it is a wonderful site. But so do the concerns of the people.
Yeah.
And I guess in the end it comes down to there's only one Mauna Kea for the Hawaiian people, but there's more than one almost perfect site for a telescope. Yeah. So I know that many of the Hawaiians that are protesting are not anti-science, they're very pro-science, and especially when it comes to navigation and stars, because that's been a big part of the Polynesian story. I think everybody wishes that there had been more consultation, and that the most important outcome that everybody's hoping for, regardless of what happens to the telescope, is that this will be a galvanizing moment for the Hawaiian community and will allow them to come together and to organize and to collect and to be ready for all of the different challenges that face them.
Yeah. Dean, this film has been just reaping in the awards. What has this experience been like for you?
Oh, it's been absolutely wonderful. And we do appreciate the awards. We won Frameline. We won a bunch of things in Polynesia. For me, the most wonderful is, you know, I'm a white guy from the East Coast coming to Hawaii. And normally I would just probably be hanging out with other people like me or surfers or whatever. But meeting Hina and being part of Hina's world and being drawn into her world has really been an extraordinary honor and a gift and a revelation for us. Just to be part of her whole circle of friends has been really an amazing way to get to know a place.
Yeah. Now, paired with this project, and as you said, it's a plot within in the greater documentary, you have a shorter kids film called A Place in the Middle. How do these two relate to each other?
Well, A Place in the Middle is the story of this amazing 11-year-old girl, Ho'onani, and her struggle to lead the boys' hula troupe. It's especially made for kids. We actually flipped around the film and made Ho'onani herself the storyteller, the narrator. We threw in some extra animation to make it fun. And it seems to be something that is not just about kids, but it's actually made for kids.
Yeah.
Kids enjoy watching it. So we did that because we wanted this teaching to be available in schools, and a 75-minute documentary is not a good thing for schools, but a 25-minute piece is great. So we're hoping that it will be used very widely in schools, first here in Hawaii and then all around the country.
Oh, amazing. Amazing stuff. Well, as I said, May 4th coming up, is there a party that you're going to have and everyone's going to watch it together?
Everybody can join the party with us by tweeting hashtag Kumuhina. People can also join in the party by taking the Pledge of Aloha. It's a pledge to live with honor, love, and respect for everybody. That's on our website at kumuhina.com, hashtag Pledge of Aloha. And people can, if they like it, if they like Kumuhina's story, if they want to see more of this type of story of a culture and gender mixed together, they can vote for the film for the Audience Award for Independent Lens. And, that's going to be the party. It's going to be an online party.
I love it. I love a good online party. Talk to me about Independent Lens. They do such great work. I remember hosting some sort of roundtable discussion years ago when I was living in Vermont about their focus on subjects who were two-spirited. They do a pretty darn good job of highlighting different communities.
Yes, public media does a wonderful job of giving voice to underserved and underheard communities and underserved filmmakers. Independent Lens has had films about two-spirited people, and they have one now coming out, Limited Partnership, about the marriage debate 50 years ago. They do really a wonderful job, and people should know they're a bit under attack these days. Some TV stations are trying to take them off the main channels, and there's a lot of support that people can give. So make sure to support Independent Lens and Indie Caucus. They really are the voice of a lot of minorities.
I had no idea they were under attack.
Yeah, well, you know, some of the conservative right-wing people have gotten really, really clever. The Koch brothers now are on the board of PBS in New York City.
Oh, my.
And apparently they didn't like Independent Lens running documentaries about their practices. So they kind of tried to get Independent Lens taken off of Channel 13.
Okay.
Which seems kind of bad, but I guess when you have $1 billion, your voice gets heard.
Yeah, yeah.
So Preserve Indies, Indie Caucus is doing a great job of making sure that these stories get heard by the public, because after all, that's the job of public media. It's not to to make ratings or to make money. It's to serve the public.
Yeah. What's coming up next for you guys? I mean, obviously, I don't want to move too quickly past. We have a big premiere coming up. We're going to be at this online party for you. Are we already thinking about what project is coming up next?
Well, you know, A Place in the Middle, I think we're going to spend the next couple of years getting to that to schools everywhere.
Yeah.
But as people in schools and kids and teachers have begun to see it, so many of them say, oh, we have kids who are in the middle. And they don't necessarily mean in the middle between male and female. They can mean in the middle between immigrant and local, or in the middle between intellectually or
yeah.
economically
yeah.
or racially in a whole lot of different ways. So I think this idea of in the middle is a powerful one for us. And we're thinking it might translate into more media on that same subject.
I love it. I love it. This is very exciting stuff, sir. Are you excited for May 4th?
Yes. You know, it's been so wonderful going to film festivals and winning awards, but TV, this show will be seen by 1 to 2 million people.
Yeah. So
it's really kind of amazing because for the vast majority of them, they'll never have seen anything like this. They'll never have heard of Mahu. They'll never have heard of this aspect of Hawaii. And we're hoping that people get their eyes opened.
Yeah. Gosh, there is so much going on in this really relatively short film. I was all prepared, Dean, to watch a film about this fluidity of gender, about inclusion, but it's so much more than that. There's this aspect of different generations and how we speak to each other, this aspect of Hawaiian culture and the appropriation there, and so much of which I just had no idea. But at the heart of this is this real commitment that you and Joe put forth on film to capture this slice of life. And you guys do such an amazing job, a real investment there. It really comes across on film.
Well, thank you very much. And I really appreciate that because we put a lot of effort into this because we think Hina's life and Ho'onani's life are important. And we think of the people need and should see about them. Other people deserve to see about them. So we just wanted to tell the story in a way that that people would actually enjoy watching.
Oh, it's so great. It's so great. All right, listeners, these are all the things you need to do. First, you need to go to Facebook and you need to like the Kumuhina page. And it's Kumuhina. It will pop right up for you. Then you need to stroll on over to kumuhina.com. We will certainly link to it. And there is so much going on this site, including you can watch A Place in the Middle. You can see all of the different aspects of the film that you should be starting conversations with other people, because this is really one of those amazing conversation starters that we all should be talking about this slice of life that doesn't get nearly enough attention. To you both, Dean Hamer, to you and Joe Wilson, who we hope feel better, what an amazing job you've done here.
Thank you so much, and it's always fun to be on your show. It's really gay.
Yeah, it's really gay. Can we not let another 6 years go by before you come back?
Okay, we'll do what we can.
All right.
Same for you.
Dean, all our best to Joe. Amazing job with this. Everybody, May 4th, it premieres on PBS, Kumuhina. Strolling over to kumuhina.com. Thank you so much for everything that you and Joe are doing, Dean.
Mahalo.
Oh,
folks, and we are back. Well, we have oodles and oodles of time to cover all of the latest LGBT news out there. I'm going to fly solo on this one. There is so much going on, so we'll be jumping around a bit. We're going to start with Washington State. Reported on last week's show, relayed to you all the news that the House of Representatives there in the great state of Washington passed a ban on conversion therapy, which was really exciting. So then it just needed to go to the Senate for Senate approval. And our good buddy Marco Elias is there in the Senate. And, you know, we were feeling pretty good and hopeful about all this. Yeah, not so much. This week, Washington State Democrats, they moved to ban these so-called gay conversion therapies, focusing on abusive practices like electric shock and ice baths. But sadly, tragically, really depressingly, they were blocked by Republican lawmakers. The Washington State Senate voted 22-27 to refuse to consider the bill. This is a quote from Marco Elias, Senator Marco Elias. He's been on the show so many times. We adore him. He said, quote, "I am appalled that the Republican majority killed legislation to protect kids from electric shock, ice baths, and other physical and emotional abuse simply because they're gay. We need to end conversion therapy once and for all." The bill had originally cleared the Senate back in March, but after changes were made in the House version, Republicans now oppose it and are insisting on their own changes. The GOP reportedly was upset at efforts to ban talk conversion therapy, which has no scientific basis, as there is no just proof that someone can simply be talked out of sexual orientation. Sadly, what this all means, folks, is that this bill is now likely dead, according to the local press. Only 5 days remain in the legislative session. Thanks to the GOP's hang-up over one provision in the bill, even the most extreme forms of gay conversion therapy will sadly remain legal in Washington State. Such a bummer. Such a bummer. And they'd done such good work. Again, conversion therapy only outlawed in like 3 places in the country. I think it's California, New Jersey, and Washington, D.C. And that's it. But yeah, they were making a move there in Washington and they were blocked. Such a bummer. Such a bummer. Over in Pennsylvania, a group of students in nearby Pittsburgh, pretty near to here, I've never been there, but I'm told it's near to Cleveland, a group of students in a Pittsburgh area high school are under scrutiny for reportedly organizing an anti-gay day. An anti-gay day. They organized it at the school last week in response to the nationally observed Day of Silence, which supports the LGBT community. According to WPXI, a group of students at McGuffey High School in Claysville, Pennsylvania, were encouraging people to wear flannel shirts and write anti-gay on their hands late last week. The students apparently organized themselves just after the school's Gay Straight Alliance arranged for students to take part in the Day of Silence, which is a national event that you all should know. It's organized by the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network to call attention to the silencing effect of anti-LGBT bullying and harassment in schools. The National Day of Silence was scheduled for last Friday, but the school held its event 2 days earlier because of a scheduling conflict. Zoe Johnson, a student at McGuffey High School, told the outlet up to 50 people took part in the Day of Silence, choosing to wear black, paint rainbows on their faces, and stay quiet for most of the days. Some students who did not support the event reportedly took swift action in response. Kathy Cameron, chair of the board of directors of the Washington County Gay Straight Alliance, told BuzzFeed, quote, "They had a very silent, respectful day of action, and then they came to school on Thursday to an organized backlash." An organized backlash. This is so nutty. The student said, quote, "There was pushing, posters hung on homosexual students' lockers, teachers were having to run out and take them down." Dr. Erica Kolot, the superintendent of McGuffey School District, issued a statement on Friday to the news outlet and confirmed the allegations are being investigated. Dr. Kolot said this, quote, "Yesterday afternoon, April 16th, 2015, allegations of harassment were brought to the attention of our administration. McGuffey School District, along with school police officers, continue to investigate all allegations. We will follow our student code of conduct and file legal citations as warranted. We resolve to ensure that all children can grow and learn in a safe, supportive environment free from discrimination." So nutty. And that's not all that happened in protesting the National Day of Silence. And by the way, if you want to learn more about the National Day of Silence, you can stroll on over. You should certainly be strolling on over to glsen.org, glsen.org. You can also, for commentary on it, you can go to thisshowisogay.com. And if you click on our guest link, you can pull up Dr. Eliza Byard. She was on our 250th episode. She's the executive director of GLSEN. And I previously had some hesitations about the Day of Silence. I didn't really get it. I don't understand if we are so silenced for the rest of the year, the LGBT population, why do we need a day that kind of commemorates how silenced we always are? I always wanted a day of shouting. And Dr. Byer just put it in such great perspective for me. And so I encourage you to stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com, click on the guests tab, and you can listen to everything that she had to say about it, because it helped me. It helped me understand it. But more protests about the National Day of Silence. This one's coming out of California. The divisions within the Bay Area's Catholic community over gay rights hit Marin Catholic High School full force the other day when a group of nuns, I don't know that I've ever talked about a group of nuns on this show before, but a group of nuns walked out of their classes to protest the sponsors of a program intended to protect gay and lesbian teens from bullying. The five members of the Dominican Sisters of Mary Order exited their classrooms Friday as students began handing out flyers at the Kentfield School promoting a nationwide Day of Silence. Here's the Day of Silence. Their walkout came one day after 100 prominent local Catholics attracted national attention by taking out a full-page ad in the Chronicle calling on the Pope to oust Archbishop Salvador Cardellone, in part for trying to get teachers at Catholic schools to sign off on a morality clause that characterizes homosexual relations as, quote, gravely evil. Marin Catholic High School President Tim Navoni and Principal Chris Valdez tried to put out the latest brush fire with a letter to parents about a, quote, challenging day on our campus, resulting in both students and faculty feeling confused about our mission. At issue was this Day of Silence. It's promoted by GLSEN, but the nuns at Marin Catholic High School saw it as anti-Catholic. The school declined to participate in the Day of Silence. Instead, a morning prayer was read over the school's PA system to acknowledge and pray for students everywhere who have the experience of being ostracized, marginalized, or silenced by bullying. A letter to parents said this, quote, "Our intention was not to take part in a Day of Silence, but rather take a moment in the morning to pray together as a school community." Unfortunately, the administrator said the school's message was compromised and misinterpreted the night before when it was linked on Facebook to the campaign by GLSEN, and they called GLSEN an activist group with which we are not affiliated. When some Marin Catholic High School students began handing out Day of Silence-related stickers and flyers on campus, the five nuns felt, quote, compromised, offended, and uncomfortable. They were compromised, that's a strong word, offended and uncomfortable, which, by the way, yeah, so too do your LGBT students often feel compromised, offended, and uncomfortable. But you, the nuns, you get to walk out. The LGBT students don't always get to do that. One of the nuns, Sister Claire Marie, I swear to you, I almost said it was Sister Marie Claire, but it's not. It's Sister Claire Marie. She said the sisters, quote, "do not support bigotry or any kind of prejudice, but they were compelled to act out against an event promoted by a group that believes actively in promoting homosexuality in all classrooms K through 12. It's such a bummer. It's such a bummer that this teacher characterized GLSEN in this way and obviously did absolutely no research. Her email, Sister Claire Marie, again, not Sister Marie Claire, that's a magazine. Her email to parents went on to say that group members of GLSEN were speaking out against Christians who do not share their views, and they were handing out materials that said that any church which teaches homosexuality is sinful, is an oppressor, and should be opposed. Hey. Carrie Hudnell, a spokeswoman for GLSEN, denied that the group, quote, actively promoted homosexuality in the classroom. Because, you know, they don't. That's not what they do. This spokeswoman for GLSEN went on to say, quote, "we are not trying to convert anyone. We are just trying to make sure schools are a safe environment for all." kids. So here you go. You got nuns walking out and making a really public statement, which, according to every piece of research done by GLSEN, and they do incredible research, I urge you to go to GLSEN.org and click on their resources tab. Incredible, incredible research. It just always culminates in the belief of LGBT students saying that they feel more unsafe when they have teachers in their schools who are speaking out against openly identifying as gay. Because there's no way that these teachers, even despite the fact that Sister Claire Marie, not Sister Marie Claire, even though Sister Claire Marie said that the sisters do not support bigotry or any kind of prejudice, it's very clear that there's a part of them that kind of does. That's what they're walking out said. This is not a group, GLSEN, that promotes homosexuality. They're just trying to make all of our schools safer. So there you go. From five nuns to Marco Rubio. That's a fun transition, isn't it? Marco Rubio, who has alternately been championed on magazine covers as the first senator from the Tea Party and the Republican savior, he is starting to roll out a more moderate portrait. In practical terms, that has meant muddying his position on marriage equality as he runs for president. Marco Rubio opposes same-sex weddings, but would attend one. I just love that. I love that. He wants the party. He might get party favors, those almonds that are covered with chocolate, maybe a donation. People do that for their wedding ceremonies, whatever it may be. He'll go. But he generally opposes same-sex weddings. He disagrees with, quote, the choice, huh? But he doesn't think that homosexuality is chosen. States should prohibit gays and lesbians from marrying, but if citizens want to change the law, they should be able to, but he hopes they won't. Basically, Marco Rubio is a walking contradiction. Last weekend, he had an interview with Face the Nation, and he said some really nutty things. Bob Schaefer, the moderator, asked him, quote, you've said you're against gay marriage. Do you think that homosexuality is a choice? And here's how Marco Rubio responded. He said, quote, well, first, it's not that I'm against gay marriage, which is kind of hilarious because Marco Rubio has supported a ban on same-sex marriage in his home state. He encouraged his state's attorney general to continue fighting to keep a marriage ban. He said at the time, quote, I do not believe that there is a U.S. constitutional right to same-sex marriage. And then he lent his voice to robocalls by the National Organization of Marriage, that horrible, hateful group. But now, while he still says that I don't believe same-sex marriage is a constitutional right, he also says it should be put up for a vote. And the advocates wrote this, that sounds a lot less like Ted Cruz and more like Chris Christie, who vetoed a marriage bill in New Jersey while saying it should be put up for majority vote. Rubio on Face the Nation went on to say this, quote, states have always regulated marriage, and if a state wants to have a different definition, you should petition the state legislature and have a political debate. I love that there has to be a political debate on this. On the question of whether being gay is a choice, Rubio was unclear. He said this, quote, I also don't believe that your sexual preferences are a choice for the vast and enormous majority of people. The bottom line is that I believe that sexual preference is something that people are born with. Okay, so I guess that's for most people, so that's a good thing. He then did an interview with Univision, and on Univision, he was sure same-sex couples had made a decision he disagreed with, even if it isn't that one about being gay in the first place. He was asked whether he'd attend a gay wedding, and he said he wanted gay and lesbian viewers to know, quote, I'm not going to hurt them, even if he disagrees with their decisions. He said this, quote, if there's someone that I love that's in my life, I don't necessarily have to agree with their decisions or the decisions they've made to continue to love them and participate in important events. When he was asked to clarify if that means he'd actually go to the wedding, he said, quote, of course I would. It's just unbelievable. I have to tell you, in many, many years of doing the show, this has been one of the hardest stories to read, and it's not because you should be calling into question my reading skills. It truly is because it's so difficult to navigate. So the advocates got this piece. It's called Listen to Marco Rubio Triangulate on Equality. It is one of the most confusing pieces I've ever read. And also, I'm having difficulty reading it then to you. So check out Marco Rubio. He has absolutely no idea what to say. And we're going to see this. We're going to see this more and more as we get closer to the election, because as we have the majority of Americans who support marriage equality, for a Republican candidate to just come out and say, no, 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 this is absolutely foreboding, that's not in their best interest. They're not going to get elected. They're not going to get elected simply by appealing to the most conservative base. So they are softening their stances, but in softening their stances, they have to reconcile that with the past things that they said. Because while you will not get elected to president, to the United States presidency by doing a hardline conservative stance, that is not to say that you couldn't do that in Florida, Marco Rubio, and in Texas, Ted Cruz, and get elected there. So they've made all sorts of comments in the past that have been really hardline conservative comments, but now they have to soften those, and they need to be held accountable for changing their minds or changing their verbiage, whichever it might be. I think half the times it's changing their verbiage, because who the heck knows if they actually are changing their minds. So that is Marco Rubio. Unbelievable. Now, turning our attention to Hillary Clinton, we talked about this last week. In her announcement that she would be running for president, her ad, her YouTube ad, which was like, you know, this amazing United Colors of Benetton, I loved it, just featured everybody all around. Well, a self-described Christian news service has taken great pains to analyze this presidential campaign launch commercial and determined that its focus is to, of course, listeners, push the homosexual agenda. One News Now, which is a website of the American Family News Network, it claims that Hillary Clinton's first campaign ad makes her, quote, promotion of the H agenda very clear for all Americans, because it features two homosexual men walking down the street holding hands with a homosexual man's voice narrating the segment. Unbelievable. This is, by the way, if you check this out, it's like a crazy typo-heavy article. It's by reporter Michael F. Haverluck. It goes on to describe another segment of the video, which, quote, highlights a lesbian couple kissing on a couch while caressing each other, which, by the way, it, you know, doesn't. These kinds of scenes depicting what he called, quote, lopsided and left-leaning treatment of the LGBT community over the traditional family, it reportedly evoked outrage from the leaders of pro-family organizations as collated by One News Now. Now, he is careful to throw out some stats. In this article, it reads, quote, Clinton is a lock for the 2.3% of the American people who are gay or bisexual. Meanwhile, the other 97.7% of the electorate isn't. What happened to us? How did we get down to 2.3% of the American people who are gay and bisexual? That's not true. It's absolutely not true. The real numbers are about twice of those quoted by Fisher. The New York Times reports 5% of voters in 2012 identified as gay, lesbian, or bisexual. In 2014, a CNN exit poll determined 4% of voters are lesbian, gay, or bisexual. So apparently, and I have to tell you, my favorite part of this is the title of the article by The Advocate. It says, Christian critics, colon, Hillary's ad is basically a Queer as Folk episode. That's funny. That's funny. It's really not, by the way. If you've watched Queer as Folk, this is not that. This is not that. Turning our attention to Michigan, holy cow, this is big news. The 40th Michigan Women's Music Festival to be held this August will be the last. The founder has announced that this week. The storied women-only event, first held in 1976, has been the subject of controversy. We have talked about it so many times on this show in the past. They have just notoriously excluded trans women. Many artists and organizations have decided to boycott it. Founder and organizer Lisa Vogel, though, she gave no reason for ending the fest. In her Facebook post, which announced the decision, she said this, quote, we have known in our hearts for some years that the life cycle of the festival was coming to a time of closure. Too often in our culture, change is met only with fear. The true cycle of life is denied to avoid the grief of loss, but change is the ultimate truth of life. Sisters, I ask you to remember that our 40-year festival has outlived nearly all of her kin. She has served us well. I want us all to have the opportunity to experience the incredible full life of our beloved festival consciously, with time to celebrate and, yes, time to grieve. Now, she did slightly acknowledge the controversy that has always been present around this festival. She wrote, quote, there have been struggles. There is no doubt about that. This is part of our truth, but it's not, and it never has been, our defining story. The festival has been this crucible for nearly every critical cultural and political issue the lesbian feminist community has grappled with for decades. Those struggles have been a beautiful part of our collective strength. They have never been a weakness. She urged the festival family to please take what you love about Michigan and use it to create something new and beautiful. So just to remind you, the exclusion of transgender women from the festival has led performers such as the Indigo Girls, we love them, Antigone Rising, we adore them. They've been on the show. And Leah Delaria, they have all withdrawn from the event. And last year, several national LGBT organizations signed on to a petition from statewide LGBT group Equality Michigan calling on the festival to change its rule limiting attendance to women born women. Festival organizers have said this is not a formal policy, but rather an intention. They're very clear about that word, intention. It's in quotes. They call it the intention. They say the intention that it puts the onus on each individual to choose whether or how to respect it, but petitioners said that did not equate to the inclusion and noted that the controversy dated back to a trans woman being thrown out of the festival in 1991. Just in the last couple of weeks, however, three signatories withdrew their endorsement of the petition. So there you go. It's still going on there. The National Center for Lesbian Rights had removed their name from the petition, and they will be actively engaged in conversations in which they honor our differences while also pursuing a conclusion that supports the gender identity and inclusion of all women in MitchFest. I think one of the greatest parts about the story is that, all right, so it's ending. This is going to be the last year, but there still will be protesting there, and there should be. This shouldn't be complacency of saying, all right, well, it's the last year, so what's the point in even trying to change it? No. Screw that. It's the 40th year. You know it's the last year, so the attendance is probably going to skyrocket because people are going to go and say, well, this is our last chance to go. So folks who are protesting it, please keep on protesting it. We'll certainly protest against it on our airwaves. I wasn't going to go anyway. But yeah, it's going to be a huge attendance. Last hurrah, and still they will be excluding trans women from going as part of their, quote, intention. Not good. Not good. Please keep protesting. We support you. We support you. Hey, a quick story from the comic book front. So exciting. This is a total spoiler alert, but I don't care because it's so exciting. Pages of this week's all-new X-Men number 40. If you listened to the show before, you know I love X-Men. Pages have leaked of that issue online, revealing one of the original five team members is gay. Who knew? Iceman, Bobby Drake. I loved Iceman. The current storyline, which is written by Brian Michael Bendis, follows young versions of the original five X-Men displaced in time and fighting the never-ending battle in present day. The reveal of Iceman's sexuality, long speculated by fans, unfolds in a scene where Jean Grey, we love Jean Grey, Marvel Girl, Phoenix, she calls the frosty mutant out for hiding who he is by overcompensating with flirtatious comments aimed at his female teammates. When he denies it, she reminds him she's a psychic and she can read his mind before he finally lets down his guard and admits he's got a thing for one of his fellow male mutants. You can go on over to The Advocate and check out the panels. I'm not super into how he comes out in this one because it's a little bit invasive. So he is asserting that he's not gay. I'm going to ruin this for you, right? So you can go check out the panels. But he's asserting that he's not gay. And then Jean Grey, his fellow X-Men who can read minds, basically goes into his mind against his will and outs him and says, no, you are. Now, she doesn't do it in front of other people. And I know some of you are probably thinking, okay, you're probably reading too much into this. It's a comic book. But no, it's a bigger deal than that. Comic books, which are huge for the LGBT community, are such a huge piece of escapism for those of us who need that escapism. For all the LGBT youth out there, not just youth, adults as well, but for the LGBT youth out there who are struggling with their sexual orientation, to have Iceman come out, that's amazing. He's a huge character in the comic book world. But to have him come out as Jean Grey reads his mind against his will and basically pushes him to admit who he is before he is clearly ready to, I don't know that I'm super into that one. It feels a little bit too aggressive for me, a little bit too much like outing there, but, you know, it is also a comic book, so I won't read too much into it. And there you go, X-Men, Iceman, he's gay. Love it. Just maybe not the method. That's it. That's my tour of all the LGBT news for the week, me just spouting off about whatever's going on. Hey, our huge thanks to Dean Hamer. We love having him on the show. I can't believe it's been 6 years. That's just so nutty to me. I think this is actually the longest stretch that we've had between guest appearances on the show. So thrilled to welcome him back. I urge you to go to kumuhina.com. Kumuhina.com. That's K-U-M-U-H-I-N-A. muhina.com. It is an incredible documentary. Incredible documentary. I'm pushing you to watch it when it premieres in just a few weeks on PBS. A whole culture that just does not get talked about nearly enough. Kumuhina.com. Thank you to Dean Hamer. Hey, you guys, thanks to you for listening. Get out there and do whatever it is that you do to use your voice to make a difference. Whether you are writing a comic book with a gay character or you are making a documentary about a voice that needs to be raised up, do it. Raise up the voices of your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. And while you're out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?
Just a sailor in a great big sea, searching for what's meant for me. And I thank my lucky stars every single day. I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be.